I don't want to look. Don't make me look.
Be calm. Be easy. Come with me only once more.
The little boy wanders down the straight row where the black soil has baked to crumbly gray dust. Gigantic plants loom over him, tassels brown against the sky, swollen cobs jutting from the stalks, ripe and ready for harvest. The boy walks on toward the noise, but it is far away from him, and so he must sit down and rest for a while. He leans against a cornstalk thick as the trunk of a young tree, and the broad green leaves shade him from the sun's heat. He closes his eyes. When he opens them again, the noise is very much louder and the air is full of dust.
Please, please.
You must go there one last time. It's the only way out for you.
Wonderment becomes unease, becomes fear, as the little boy sees an orange monster chewing toward him. Its robot brain conscientiously scanning the rows ahead for signals from a beeper trace that would trigger instant emergency shutoff. But there is no signal. The machine moves on. The boy runs ahead of it, easily outdistancing the harvester's steady 1 km/h pace.
She knew. She looked for me on the scanner at lunchtime and only found the dog sending 2 signals instead of 1 there in the yard. She knew I had to be out in the fields. She called Daddy to have him stop the harvester and look for me, but there was no answer. He was outside the farm con tower, trying to fix a stuck rotor on one of the antennas.
Yes, go on. You can see her looking for you in the egg.
The little boy dashes on, too inexperienced to realize that he should move to the side, out of range of the machine, instead of continuing down the row immediately ahead of it. He runs faster, and a stitch comes in his side. He begins to whimper and runs more slowly. He trips, falls, gets up and staggers on with tears blinding his bright blue eyes. Up in the air, an egg flyer hovers over him. He stops and waves his arms, screaming for his mother. The harvester moves along, cutting the stalks off at ground level, hauling them into its maw on a spiked conveyor, chopping, shredding, plucking the kernels from the cobs, reducing the rows of giant plants to neat packages of grain and finely ground cellulose pulp.
No, please, no more!
You must, we must, once more, and then gone forever, trust me.
The egg lands, and the child stands stock still, waiting for his mother to save him, weeping and holding out his arms as she runs toward him, picks him up, with the noise louder and louder and the dust swirling about them in the hot sun. She holds him close to her as she pushes obliquely through the tough, impeding stalks, while the great orange thing moves on. Cutter beams and carrying spikes and whirling knives at work. But the 15 meters she must traverse are too far. She gasps and lifts the boy high and throws him, so that the green corn plants and the orange machine and the blue sky all spin very slowly around him. He falls to the earth, and the harvester rumbles past, with the busy clanking of its machinery drowning out another noise. That did not last very long.
Oh, Jesus, I can still hear. Please, no, the machine stops, and he comes and screams at me. You murdering little animal, Carrie, Carrie. Oh, my God, no, Daddy. Daddy, Mommy fell her. Oh, my God, Carrie, you did it to save him, and he killed you. And it's his fault, the murdering little animal. No, no. What am I saying? God, my own little boy. Steiny, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. Oh, God. Carrie. Steiny. Daddy, please keep me.
He did, Stein.
I know now.
You heard it all that he said.
Yes. Poor Daddy. He couldn't help saying it. I know now. Angry and frightened and helpless. I understand. He shot the dog, though. But I don't have to be afraid. He couldn't help it. Poor Daddy. I understand. Thank you. Thank you.
Stein opened his eyes. An unfamiliar woman's face was very near to him, sun-reddened round cheeks, a turned-up nose, intent indigo eyes set a bit too closely together. She smiled. He said,
"And I don't have to be angry at either one of us."
"No," Suki said. "You'll be able to remember and feel sad, but you'll be able to forget it. No guilt or fear or anger about this part of your life ever again."
Stein lay without speaking, and she let her mind merge with his in a touch that admitted a sharing of his ordeal, bespoke her care for him.
"You've been helping me," he said, "healing me. And I don't even know your name."
"I'm Sue Gwen Davies. My friends call me Suki. It's a silly sort of name."
"Oh, no."
He got up onto one elbow and studied her with an innocent curiosity. "You went through the Auberge training program, too.
I saw you the first and second days I was there, and then you were gone. You must have passed through the gate ahead of our Group Green."
"I was in Group Yellow. I remember you, too. That Viking costume isn't easy to miss."
He grinned and shook sweat-tousled elf locks out of his eyes.
"It seemed like a good idea back then, sort of reflection of my personality. What are you supposed to be?"
She gave a self-conscious little laugh and toyed with the embroidered belt of her long gown.
"An ancient Welsh princess. My family came from there a long time ago, and I thought it might be fun. A complete break with my old life."
"What were you? A redactor?"
"Oh, no. I was a policewoman. A juvenile officer on ON-15, the last Earth colonial satellite."
She touched her silver torque.
"I didn't become an operant redactor until I got here. I'll have to explain about that."
But he broke in.
"I tried metapsychic treatment before. It never helped. They said I was too strong, that it would take a special kind of practitioner, one with commitment, to ever get down inside of me and root my mess out, and you did it."
She protested.
"Elizabeth did all the preliminary lancing. I was trying to do it."
Her eyes slipped away from his.
"And I bungled the job badly. Elizabeth did a marvelous fix and drained out all the really dangerous stuff that I couldn't touch. You owe her a lot, Stein. So do I."
He looked dubious. "Back at the Auberge, me and my pal Richard called her the Ice Queen. She was a very cryogenic and spooky lady.
But wait. She told us that her metafunctions were lost."
"They returned. The shock of passing through the time portal did it. She's a marvelous redactor, Stein. She used to be one of the top teachers and counselors in her sector. She was masterclass. I'll never be so good. Except, perhaps, with you."
Very carefully, he folded her in his huge arms. Her hair was long and black and very straight, with a simple grassy perfume from the Tanu soap. She lay against his bare chest, hearing his heart beating slowly, afraid to look into his mind in case the thing that she had hoped for would not be found. They were alone now in the tower room. Even Elizabeth had disappeared when it became clear that the healing would be a success. Suki said,
"There are things you have to know."
She touched the silver torque about her rather plump neck.
"These silver collars. Your friend Aiken got one too, and so have some other people who've passed through the portal. They make latent metafunctions operant. That's how I became a redactor. And there's an exotic race living here in the Pliocene along with us. They're called Tanu. And they came here a long time ago from some galaxy light millennia away. They're latents, too. And they wear golden collars that make them almost as powerful as the metapsychics of our milieu. They look quite human, except for being very tall and having mostly blonde hair and funny eyes. The Tanu rule this place, almost like the barons of the Middle Ages ruled ancient Earth."
"I'm beginning to remember," Stein said slowly. "A fight in a kind of castle. Are we still locked up in that place?"
Suki shook her head. They took us, you and me and a few others, down the River Rhone. We're on our way to the Tanu capital. This is a place called Darisk, almost at the Mediterranean shore. We've been here for 2 days. Elizabeth helped the mistress of the place, who was having a hard time in childbirth. So we got to stay and fix you up and rest as a kind of reward. The river trip down here was pretty nerve-wracking.
So Elizabeth is here, and Aiken.
Who else? Brian from your group and another man named Raymo Hakkinen, who used to be a forester in British Columbia. I think he was in Group Orange. And there is a Tanu man in charge of bringing us to their capital city. His name is Cran, and he seems to be some kind of exotic physician when he's not acting as a prisoner escort. He healed all of the wounds you got in the fight, by the way, and without using any regen tank either. Just something like plas wrapping and mind power. The rest of your friends and the other people who were being kept prisoner in the castle were sent to another place hundreds of kilometers north of here.
What are they planning to do with us?
Well, Elizabeth is special, obviously, because it seems she's the only human in all of exile who is operant without a torque. I suppose they plan to make her queen of the world if she'll stand for it.
Jesus H. Christ.
And Brian, he's another special case, no torque on him either. I haven't discovered why, but the Tanu appear to think that they need an anthropologist to explain what all of us humans have done to their Pliocene society. Coming through the time gate, you see. It's very complicated, but, well, silver torque wearers like Aiken and me and Raymo, the ones with latent metabilities made operant, we have a chance to join the aristocracy of the Tanu if we behave ourselves. Ordinary people who aren't latent don't seem to be enslaved or anything. The exotics have some kind of small ape to do the rough work. The ordinaries that we saw were working at various arts and crafts.
Stein raised his hands to touch his own torque, then tried to undo it by twisting and pulling. Can't get the damn thing off. You say it'll turn on my latent metafunctions? Suki looked stricken.
Stein, your torque, it isn't silver. It's some gray metal. You're not a latent.
A dangerous gleam came into the bright blue eyes. Then what's my torque for?
Her lower lip caught between her teeth. She reached out one hand to the metal around his neck. In a voice that was scarcely more than a whisper, she said, "It controls you. It gives pleasure or pain. The Tanu can use it to communicate with you telepathically, or they can use it to locate you if you run away. They can put you to sleep and soothe your anxieties and program hypnotic suggestions and do other things, probably, that I don't know about yet." She explained more about the operation of the Torx as she knew it. Stein sat, ominously quiet, on the edge of the bed. When she had finished, he said,
"So the ones who wear gray mostly do jobs that are essential or potentially vital to the exotics. Soldiers, gate guardians, this boatman taking us down a dangerous river. And they do their jobs without rebelling, even though they're not turned into zombies by the damn torque."
"Most of the gray wearers that we've met behaved normally and seemed happy enough. Our boat skipper said he loved his job. One of the palace people that I talked to here said that the Tanu are kind and generous unless you go against their orders. I expect that after a time, you simply do as they expect you to without any coercion at all. You're conditioned and loyal. It's really the same sort of socialization that takes place in any tight group. But the loyalty is guaranteed."
Very quietly, Stein said, "I won't be a goddamn flunky for some exotic slave master. I came through the time gate and gave up everything I owned to get away from all that, to be a natural man, free to do as I pleased. I can't live any other way. I won't. He'll have to burn out my brain first."
Eyes swimming. Suki let her fingers stray to his cheek. Her mind slipped beneath his surface consciousness and saw that he was telling the simple truth. The obstinacy that had shut out every healer save the one who had loved him now stood unyielding before any notion of adaptation, totally rejecting the thought of making the best of a difficult situation. Stein would never bend to the Tano. He would break. If they dominated him at all, they would dominate only his mindless shell. Tears spilled, splashing onto the bedsheets and the wolfskin kilt that Stein still wore. He took both of her hands. She said,
"It didn't turn out to be the world that any of us dreamed about, did it? I was going to find the tunnel leading to the Hollow Earth Paradise, to Agartha. Crayon said that the legends had to refer to the paradise his people founded here. But that can't be true, can it? Agartha was a land of perfect peace and happiness and justice. This can't be the same place, not if it makes you miserable."
He laughed. "I'm a hard case, Suki. Things will be different for you. You'll get to join the high life, be a Pliocene princess instead of just a Welsh one." She pulled away from him.
"I forgot one other important thing about this exile world. Human women. The Tanu undo our Salpingzaptomy and restore our fertility. Their own women don't reproduce very well on Earth, and so they use us, too. Some human women become Tanu wives, like the lady of this palace that we're in right now. But a lot of us are just used as...
Stein drew her close to him again and wiped her tears away with a corner of the bedclothes.
"Oh, no. Not you, Suki. It won't happen to you."
Incredulously, she raised her face. He said,
"Go ahead. Look deep inside. As long as it's you, I don't mind."
She took a shuddering breath and plunged into the new place and could not help crying out when she found that what she hoped for did exist, all new and strong. After he had hushed her, and the pledge was sealed in both their minds, they completed the healing of each other in their own way. 17. Claude and Richard and Amory could have slept for days, but with the sunrise came a distant howling of amphisians angling up the ridge from the south, and they realized that the Tanu were going to do their utmost to prevent the escape of Felice, whose role in the massacre had doubtless been betrayed by some recaptured prisoner. The remnant of Group Green didn't waste any time trying to destroy traces of their camp, but marched on not long after dawn, deflating their equipment and eating a scratch breakfast as they went. Claude had attempted to relinquish leadership to Felice, but she refused to hear of it.
"You've had experience in this kind of travel. I haven't. Just get us off this bridge as quickly as you can and down into the thick woodland with a good-sized river. Then I think we'll be able to shake off the trackers."
They skidded and tramped and once even rappelled over a small cliff in their downhill flight, making better time when they found a dry wash that turned into a thin rivulet in the lower elevations. Trees crowded together and became taller, roofing over the widening stream and shading them from some of the sun's heat. As they splashed down the rock-clogged watercourse, they startled big brown trout and fishing weasels that resembled pale minks. They took to the stream bank, first on one side, then on the other, in an attempt to confuse pursuit. Claude had them tramp an obvious trail up a tributary creek, relieve themselves to enhance the spore, then double back in the water and continue wading down the original stream. It was becoming dangerously deep in places, broken with short pour-offs and stretches of white water. Claude called a halt in mid-morning. He and Felice were in good shape, but Richard and the nun sagged with weary gratitude. They rested on half-submerged rocks out in Backwater Pool, straining their ears for sounds of pursuit. They heard nothing but an explosive splat a short distance downstream.
"If I didn't know better," Amory remarked, "I'd say that was a beaver."
"Quite likely," Claude said. "Might be our old friend Castor, but it's more likely steniofiber, a more primitive type that didn't go in much for dams, but just dug holes in the..."
"Shh," Felice hissed. "Listen."
Rushing water, birdsong, the occasional screeches of what Claude had told them was an arboreal ape, a small squirrel chattering its annoyance, and something large clearing its throat. They froze on their rocks and instinctively drew up their legs, which they had been dangling in the water. The noise was a guttural cough, unlike anything they had heard before in the Pliocene. The bushes on the left bank swayed slightly as an animal passed through and came down to the stream to drink. It was a cat, massive as an African lion, but with large canine teeth protruding like daggers below its closed jaws. It muttered to itself like a dyspeptic gourmet after an overly lavish feast and took a few desultory laps. Its upper body was decorated with marbled polygons of russet, edged with tan and black. These merged into dark stripes about the animal's face and black spots on its underparts and lower limbs. It had whiskers of heroic proportions. The breeze shifted and carried the scent of the humans to the drinking saber-tooth. It raised its head, stared directly at them with yellow eyes, and snarled, exuding the studied restraint of a creature in complete command of an awkward situation. Felice met its gaze. The others were immobile with horror, waiting for the cat to spring into the water. But it did no such thing. Its belly was full, and its cubs were waiting, and Felice's mind stoked its feline vanity and told it that the scrawny prey, crouching on the rocks, was scarcely worth a ducking. So the Macheridus lapped and glared at them and wrinkled the bridge of its nose in a contemptuous one-sided snort, and at last withdrew into the undergrowth.
"It will take me 5 minutes," Amory whispered, "to offer a mass of thanksgiving. And long overdue."
Felice shook her head with an enigmatic smile, and Richard turned away looking superior, but Claude came to Amory's rock and shared the gold thimble of wine and the flake of dried bread from the mass kit she carried in the pocket of Richard's uniform. And when that was over, they went on their way again, chopping a path on the bank opposite from that claimed by the saber-tooth.
"It was so incredibly beautiful," the nun said to Claude. "But why does it need those teeth? The big cats of our time got along nicely with shorter ones."
"Our lions and tigers didn't try to kill elephants," Richard exclaimed. "You mean those monstrous hoe-tuskers they tried to frighten us with in the auberge, Trides, here? More likely the smaller mastodons in these uplands. Gamphotherium angustidens is probably the common sort, hardly half the size of those rhinos we dodged yesterday. We won't run into Deinotherium until we have to cross a swamp or a large river bottomland."
"Kaleidoscopic," the pirate growled. "Pardon me for asking, but do any of you aces have a destination in mind, or are we just running?"
Claude said softly.
"We're just running. When we've shaken off the soldiers and the bear dogs, then there'll be time enough to make strategic decisions. Or don't you agree, son?"
"Oh, shit,"
said Richard, and began hacking at the streamside shrubbery once more. At last, the brook merged with a large, turbulent river flowing in a southerly direction. Claude thought it might be the upper Saône.
"We won't follow this river," he told the rest of the group. "It probably curves around to the southwest and empties into the lake 40 or 50 kilometers downstream. We'll have to cross over, and that means the decimal bridges."
Each survival unit was equipped with 3 bridge sections that could be married to produce a narrow, self-supporting span 20 meters in length that resembled a ladder with close-set rungs. Moving up the river to a point where the torrent narrowed between 2 craggy shelves of rock, they inflated and ballasted the sections, joined them, and swung the bridge over to the opposite bank.
"Looks kind of flimsy," Richard remarked uneasily. "Funny, when we practiced with it back at the auberge, it seemed a lot wider."
The bridge was a good 1/3 of a meter in width and steady as a rock. However, they had used it to cross a still pond in the auberge's cavern, while here surging rapids and sharp rocks awaited below.
"We could inflate another bridge and lash the 2 side by side if it would make you feel better," Amory suggested.
But the pirate bristled indignantly at the suggestion, hoisted his pack,
and lurched across like an apprentice tightrope walker.
"You next, Amarie," said Claude.
The nun stepped confidently onto the span. How many hundreds of logs had she walked over, crossing the mountain streams of the Oregon Cascades? The bridge rungs were less than a hand span apart, impossible to fall through. All that was necessary was a firm grip, balanced posture, and keep the eyes on the opposite bank, and not on the foaming chute 6 meters below. Her right thigh muscle went into spasm. She teetered, caught herself, then overbalanced on the opposite side and went feet first into the river.
"Dump your pack!" Felice screamed.
Moving so fast that her hands were blurred, she dropped the bow and arrows, unfastened her own backpack, slapped the quick-release buckles of her cuirass and greaves, and jumped in after Amarie. Richard gaped from the other side, but the old man ran back the way he had come, to the relative calm of the smaller stream's outspate. Two heads bobbed in the rapids, the leading one fetched momentarily against a humpbacked boulder and disappeared. The second one swept up to the rock and also went under. But after a long minute, both women reappeared and floated toward Claude. He seized a stout piece of driftwood and held it out. Felice caught hold with one hand, and he was able to pull her in. Her other hand had the fingers entwined in Amarie's hair. Claude waded out and dragged the nun onto the bank. Felice rested on hands and knees in the shallows, spewing and coughing. He lifted Amarie's sodden body in a jackknife bend to empty the lungs of water, then filled them with his own warm air.
"Breathe, child," he begged her. "Live, daughter."
There was a sound of gagging, a first halting expansion of the chest beneath the soaked and torn starship captain's uniform. One last kiss of shared breath, and she returned.
Amory's eyes opened, and she stared wildly at Claude, then at the smiling Felice. A choked sob rose in her throat, and she buried her head in the old man's breast.
He had Felice pull the warm Orcadian sweater from his pack and wrap the nun in it, but when he tried to pick Amarie up and carry her across the bridge, she was much too heavy for him. So it was the little athlete who had to assist the nun, while the paleontologist toted his own and Felice's gear. Amarie's pack with its medical supplies was lost, swept far downstream. They had to set her broken arm with the meager first aid equipment from the individual survival units, following steps outlined in a laconic plaque entitled Common Medical Emergencies. The injury was a simple fracture of the left humerus, easily reduced even by amateur medics. But by the time Amarie was treated and sedated, the afternoon was well advanced. Richard convinced Claude and Felice that it would be useless to try to press on farther, regardless of possible pursuit. They went a short distance from the river into a concealing grove of massive oaks. There Richard erected 2 decimal cabins, while Felice went out and shot a big fat roebuck, and Claude grubbed nourishing cattail tubers from a boggy spot. With their stomachs full, cots set on maximum soft, and critter-proof screen doors latched, they fell asleep even before night fell. They never heard the owls and nightingales and tree frogs singing, nor the fading howls of bear dogs raging on a cold and futile trail far to the south. They did not see the mist start to rise from the rapids as the stars brightened. And they never saw the glowing grotesqueries of the Fearvalog, who came and danced on the opposite bank of the river, until the stars paled with the coming of dawn. The following morning, Amarie was feverish and weak. By common consent, they dosed her with their limited store of medication, made her comfortable in one hut, and withdrew to the other so that she could sleep and mend. They all stood in need of recuperation, and there seemed little danger that any pursuit party could cross the crag-bordered torrent without their being aware of it. Felice was confident that they had eluded the trackers altogether. "They might even find equipment from Amarie's pack downstream and decide that we've drowned in the river." So they slept, lunched on cold venison and algeprote, and then sat in the shade of an ancient oak, sipping small cups of precious instant coffee and trying to decide what to do next.
"I've been working on a new plan," said Felice. "I've considered different possibilities and decided that the best place to get another Torque would be near Fenaya, where there are plenty of Tano. They might even have a storehouse or a factory for the things. What we have to do is hide out until Amari is healed, cross the Vosges, then hole up outside the city. We can rustle supplies from caravans or outlying settlements."
Richard choked on his coffee. Felice went on serenely.
"And then, after we've analyzed their defenses and learned more about the actual technology of the Torques, we can work out plans for the strike."
Richard set his little cup down on a tree root with great care. "Kid, you've conned us and bullied us into going along with your plans so far. And I'm not saying you didn't do a damn good job getting us away from Ippon and her stooges. But there is no way you're going to force me into a four-man invasion of a whole city full of exotic mind mashers."
"You'd prefer to hide in the woods until they hunt you down?" she sneered. "They won't stop searching, you know. And the Tano will be coming out themselves, instead of just sending human slaves. If we follow my plan, if I get a golden Torque, I'll be a match for any of them."
"That's what you say. How do we know you'll be able to get it up? And what's in it for us? Do we get to be your loyal spear carriers while you're playing Madam Commander? No friggerty golden Torques are going to do the rest of us poor normals any good. Sure as shit some of us would get chopped by these freaks before your private guerrilla war was over, win or lose. You want to know what my plans are, Bull Dolly?" She sipped her drink, eyes hooded. "I'll tell you," Richard blustered. "I'm going to rest up here for another day or two and repair my foot gear. And then I'm heading north to the big rivers and the ocean, just like Yosh did. A little luck and I might even meet up with him. When I get to the Atlantic, I'm sailing southward along the coast. While you're doing your bandit princess routine, I'll be getting pissed on good wine and bouncing broads in my pirate shack in Bordeaux." "And the rest of us?" Claude kept his tone neutral. "Come with me. Why not? I'll be marching easy, not breaking my butt, climbing to hell and gone over the Vosges. Listen, Claude, you and Amory stick with me and I'll help you find some nice peaceful place the Tanu never heard of. You're kind of old to get mixed up in this crazy kid's battles. And what life would it be for a nun, for God's sake? This one kills people for fun."
Felice said, "You're wrong, Richard," and drank coffee.
The old paleontologist turned from one to the other, then shook his head. "I've got to think about this. And there's something else I've been meaning to do. If you don't mind, I'll just go a little farther into this grove of oak trees and spend some time alone." He got to his feet, felt briefly in the big pocket of his bush jacket, and walked off.
"Take as long as you like, Claude," Felice called. "I'll see to Amory, and keep a lookout, too."
"Don't get lost," Richard added. Felice muttered an expletive under her breath. Claude wandered along, automatically noting landmarks as he had done for so many years on freshly tamed planets. An oak with two massively drooping branches like ogre arms, a reddish pinnacle standing out amidst the gray granite, a dry meadow with a maple. One branch turned anomalously golden too early in the season, a little pool dotted with pink water lilies, with a pair of ordinary mallard ducks swimming lackadaisically about, a spring issuing from the rocks, adorned with lacy ferns and shaded by a magnificent beach.
"How's this, Jen?" the old man inquired.
He knelt down and held out his palms to the trickle, drank, then laved his forehead and the sunburnt back of his neck.
"Aspergus me domine hisopo et mundabor, lavabis me et supernivum dialbabor."
"Yes, I think this will do very well."
He took a thin flat stone from the basin of the spring and went to the foot of the beech tree. After carefully removing a pad of moss, he dug a hole, set the carved wooden box into it, and replaced the soil and plants, patting them firm. He marked her resting place with no stone nor cross. Those who cared about her knew where her dust lay. When he was finished, he went back to the spring for a handful of water to refresh the disturbed moss, then sat down with his back against the tree trunk and closed his eyes. When he awoke, it was late afternoon. Something crouched at the spring and watched him with a wary, light green gaze. Claude held his breath. It was one of the most beautiful little animals he had ever seen. Its graceful and sinuous body not much longer than his hand, with a slender tail adding another 20 centimeters to its length. Its underparts were pale orange, and the upper fur tan with subtle black shading, rather like a kit fox. The feline face was full of intelligence, mild and unthreatening. For all that, it resembled that of a miniaturized cougar. It had to be Felis Zitelli, one of the earliest of the true cats. Claude pursed his lips and whistled a soft, undulating call. The animal's large ears cupped toward the sound. With infinite slowness, Claude slipped his hand into the pocket and withdrew a small piece of cheese-like algaprote. "Psst, psst, psst," he invited, placing the food on the mossy sward beside him. Calmly, the little cat came to him, nostrils quivering, white whiskers pointing forward. It sniffed the food discreetly, tested it with a dainty pink tongue, and ate it. Eyes proportionately larger than those of a domestic cat, and outlined in black, looked at Claude in an unmistakably friendly fashion. There was a faint humming sound. Felis Zitelli was purring. The old man gave it more food, then ventured to touch it. The cat accepted his stroking, arching its back and curling its black-tipped tail into an interrogative curve. It came closer to Claude and butted its forehead against the side of his leg. "Oh, you are a cutie, aren't you? Tiny little teeth. Do you eat insects and little rock critters, or do you fish for minnows?" The cat tilted its head and bestowed a melting glance, then leaped into his lap, where it settled down with every evidence of familiarity. Claude petted the pretty thing and spoke softly to it, while shadows purpled and a chill breeze stole through the grove. "I'll have to be going," he said reluctantly, slipping one hand beneath the warm little belly and lifting the cat to the ground. He got to his feet, expecting the animal to take flight at the movement and flee. But it only sat down and watched him, and when he moved away, it followed. He chuckled and said, "Shoo!" But it persisted. "Are you an instant domestic?" he asked it, and then thought of Amarie, who would face a long stint of convalescence with him and Richard on their way north. If they left Felice behind, and there seemed no alternative, the nun would fret about her as well as brood over her own guilts. Perhaps this charming little cat would be a distraction. "Will you ride in my pocket, or do you prefer shoulders?" He picked it up and inserted it into the bellows-like pocket of his jacket. It turned about several times, and then settled down with its head out, still purring. "That's that, then." The old man lengthened his stride, passing from landmark to landmark, until he came back into the open part of the oak grove where they had set up camp. The two decimal cabins were gone. Throat constricted, heart racing, Claude staggered back behind a huge tree bole, leaning with his back to the trunk until his pulse slowed. He peered cautiously out, studying the clearing where the camp had been. It was empty of their equipment. Even the fire trench and the remains of the roasted deer were gone. There were no footprints, no broken ferns or shrubs to indicate a scuffle. Take Felice without a fight? Nothing to show there had ever been human beings among the big old trees. Claude left his place of concealment and did a more careful search. The site had been cleaned up by persons who knew their woodcraft, but there remained a few clues. One dusty place bore parallel sweep marks from the branch that had been used to obliterate footprints, and down by the torrent on a faint game trail that led upstream was a piece of emerald-green fluff stuck to the resiny trunk of a pine. A bit of green feather, dyed green. Claude nodded as the puzzle began to resolve itself. They had found three people in three packs and taken them this way. Who? Certainly not the minions of the Tanu, who would not care about concealing their presence. Then, Fearvalog? Claude's heart leaped again, and he pinched his nostrils shut and exhaled gently. The adrenaline flood was stemmed and the pounding in his chest eased. There was nothing to do but follow. And if they caught him, well, at least he had fulfilled part of what he had come here to do. "You're sure you don't want to get off?" he whispered to the cat, crouching and pulling open the pocket to afford an easy egress. But the animal only blinked its big eyes sleepily and cuddled down out of sight. "It's us versus them, then," Claude said, sighing. He set a good pace and hiked up the noisy river until it was nearly dark. Then he smelled smoke, and followed his nose into a stand of sequoias on a rocky slope above the river. There was a sizable fire, surrounded by many dark figures who were laughing and talking. Claude lurked among the shadows, but he was evidently expected. Completely against his will, he found himself walking up to the fire with his hands above his head, drawn by the same irresistible compulsion he had known in the examining chamber of the Lady Ippone. "It's an old one," somebody said as he came into the firelight.
"Not such an altar cocker, though," a hulking shape remarked. "He might be good for something.
Acting more reasonable than his friends, anyhow."
There were perhaps a dozen tough-looking human men and women seated on the ground around the flames. They were dressed in dark buckskin and oddments of ragged costume, eating the last bits of Felice's venison and turning a long spit crowded with spatchcocked birds. One desperado arose and came over to Claude. It was a middle-aged woman of medium height, with dark hair graying at the temples, and eyes that displayed a fanatic sparkle in the firelight. Her thin lips tightened critically as she studied the old man. She lifted the fine beak of her nose in a proud gesture, and Claude could see a golden torque nestled beneath the collar of her doeskin cloak.
"What do you call yourself?" she asked sternly.
"I'm Claude Majeski. What have you done with my friends? Who are you?"
The mind grip gentled, and the woman looked at him with astringent humor.
"Your friends are safe enough, Claude Majeski. As for myself, I am Angelique Goudrion. You may call me Madame."
18. The River Rhone flowed slow and wide. The boat, even with its sail fully spread and its small engine working, was a long time leaving the Isle of Darisk behind. The watery plains of the Camargue shimmered with a golden haze that blurred regions a kilometer or so away into an indistinct scrim backdrop. Later, as the boat traveled farther south, the passengers caught sight of mountains on their left and the tops of occasional rock outcroppings in the swamp, but there was no sign of the sea. And some little orange and blue reedlings and red-headed buntings teetered on the tall papyrus growing beside the river's main channel. The bubble top was off all morning, and the passengers watched, fascinated, as crocodiles and dugongs cruised around them. Once there was a shoal of marvelous water snakes, nearly transparent and shining like undulant rainbows beneath the hazy sun. Around noon they pulled into another island where more than 20 boats were gathered. Cargo craft, small yachts conveying brightly garbed Tanu, larger vessels crowded with silent little Ramas, sitting five abreast on rows of benches like small unchained galley slaves who had lost their oars. The island had only a few low buildings. Skipper Hijon explained that they would not disembark here, only stop long enough to reinstall the bubble panels.
Not another damn shoot the chutes, groaned Ramo.
He pulled out his flask.
The very last, Hijon soothed him. And not rough, even though it's a bit steep. One of the unreconstructed Gorps who piloted Tanu barges through here back in the earliest days of the time portal named the thing La Glissade Formidable. Sounds classier than the dreadful slide, so that's what we call it today, too.
Stein, sitting in the seat beside Suki, looked puzzled.
But we should be in the Rhone Delta now. Bang on the Mediterranean shore. What kind of gradient can there be?
You're in for a surprise, Brian told him. I couldn't believe it myself when the skipper explained it to me. I used to sail the Med too, you'll remember. What it adds up to, Stein, is a slight miscalculation on the part of the boffins who drew up our Pliocene maps. The workmen installing the transparent panels gave the last one a smack and said,
"You're off, Captain." "Belt in, everyone," Hijon ordered. "You come forward, Brian. You're gonna love this one."
A light wind sprang up as they puttered away from the moorage, following in the wake of a 30-meter barge loaded with metal ingots. The vapors that obscured their view finally dissipated, and they looked to the south for a first glimpse of the sea. They saw a cloud.
"What the hell is that?" Stein wondered. "Looks like a plas factory on fire or a big volcano vent. Friggity cloud goes clear to the tropopause."
The mast of the riverboat folded and withdrew, and the auxiliary engine cut out. They began to pick up speed. The clumps of marsh grass were more widely spaced now, and the boat followed a marked channel that treaded southeastward, close beneath a rounded headland on their left that jutted into the flats as an outlier of the alpine foothills. They were heading directly toward the towering white cloud, picking up speed every minute. And then Elizabeth said,
"Dear Lord, the Mediterranean is gone."
The barge that was traveling about half a kilometer ahead of them dropped out of sight. To the east and west along the horizon were low points of land, but between them was only a line of water meeting milky sky, having a shallow dip in the center. And there was a sound, a swelling rumble with a hissing component that grew to deafening proportions as they swept closer and closer to La Glissade Formidable, where the wide expanse of the Rhone extended at the continental brink. Crane's mental voice rang in the brains of all the torque wearers.
"Shall I program oblivion?"
But they all replied, "No!" For their curiosity was greater than any terror of what lay ahead. The boat raced over the edge and started down, borne on muddy waters cascading over a steep fan of sediment, plunging at 80 kilometers an hour into the depths of the empty sea. They came to the end of the glissade after 4 hours and floated in the pale waters of a great, bitter lake. All around them were the many-colored rocks of the continental routes and glistening, fantastically eroded shapes of salt and anhydrite and gypsum. With its bubble panels stowed away, the boat spread its sail and raced along toward the southwest, for it was there that Crayon told them that the capital city of Moriah lay, at the tip of the Balearic Peninsula, which the Tanu called Aver, above the perfect flat of the White Silver Plain. They traveled for one more day, overcome by the strangeness and the beauty, and hardly able to talk about it, except for endless exclamations in both the vocal and mental speech, to which Crayon responded, "Yes, it is wonderful. And more to come. More splendid than you can imagine." In the late evening on the sixth day after they had departed from Castle Gateway, they arrived. The high peninsula of Avon stretched away into the west, green and rolling, with a single peak near its tip and other eminences half hidden in haze. A team of Helidothria in glowing trappings of rainbow fabric pulled the boat up a long rollered way, while Chalico riders dressed in gauzy robes and glass armor, bearing lights, animal-headed horns and banners, followed along the steep towpath. The welcoming Tanu sang all the way to the blazing city high above the salt. Their song had a haunting melody that seemed strangely familiar to Brian, but those human beings who wore the torque were able to understand the alien words. Ligan no po kon ne si, kon olan le pred neer, u tenel compri la nain, nib le pan algar de don, shompri pon agabrinel, shalukar metan presi, narmetan ubar tenel opoga kon, karmetan sed gon mori. There is a land that shines through life and time, a comely land through the length of the world's age, and many colored blossoms fall on it from the old trees where the birds are singing. Every color glows there, delight is commonplace. Music abounds on the silver plain, on the gentle-voiced plain of the many-colored land, on the white-silver plain to the south. There is no weeping, no treachery, no grief. There is no sickness, no weakness, no death. There are riches, treasures of many colors, sweet music to hear, the best of wine to drink. Golden chariots contend on the plain of sports. Many-colored steeds run in days of lasting weather. Neither death nor the ebbing of the tide will come to those of the many-colored land. Part 3. The Alliance. 1. The giant sequoia had endured for 10,000 years. Standing amidst a grove of lesser specimens high in the Vosges, it was hollowed by ancient wildfire and rot. In millennia past, lightning had sheared its top, so that the tree was only about 100 meters in height. The trunk nearest the ground spanned fully a fourth of that distance, giving the sequoia the appearance of a huge truncated pylon. That it lived at all was evidenced only by sparse branches writhing at the broken crown, their small needles seemingly incapable of photosynthesizing enough sugar to nourish such a monument. The sequoia was host to a family of fire-backed eagles and several million carpenter ants. Since early in the afternoon, it had also harbored a band of free-living humans, who were accustomed to use the great hollow trunk as a safe house at times of particular danger. A thin rain fell. In another hour it would be dark. A woman in a water-stained doe-skin cloak stood beside one buttress of the great bowl, her eyes shut, her fingertips pressed to her throat. After 5 minutes had passed, she opened her eyes and wiped some of the moisture from her forehead. Stooping, she pulled aside the fronds of a large fern and entered an inconspicuous opening, a nearly healed fissure that led into the interior of the tree. Someone helped her out of the sodden cloak. She nodded her thanks. All around the inner perimeter of the trunk, small fires burned on low stone platforms, their smoke plumes plaiting together with that of a larger central blaze and rising toward the natural chimney high above. The main fire was laid on a great X-shaped hearth. Its flames towered at the center and diminished to a comfortable cooking height at the ends of the arms. People were gathered around the central fire in great numbers. Smaller groups huddled near the subsidiary fireplaces. The place smelt of steaming clothing spread before the flames, of baking ash bread and pots of hot spiced wine, and of simmering meat stew. Richard hovered over the stew kettle, snarling at the cooks and occasionally adding dried herbs from a collection of crocks at his feet. Claude and Felice sat together nearby, and Amory was using her good arm to lay out medical supplies on a clean blanket. The nun's tiny wildcat watched with keen interest, having learned quickly that the drug doses, dressings, and instruments were not playthings or prey. Angelique Gudrion came to this side of the fire and extended her hands to the warmth. She said to Amory,
"It's a good thing, Master, that Fithorn and the other Fervilog were able to retrieve your pack. We are always short of medical supplies, and we will have great need of your secular skills as well as your spiritual ones. There are no professional healers among us, since all such persons are subjected to the bondage of the Grey Torc as soon as their expertise is discovered. We can only presume that your own Torcless state is the result of a Tanu error.
And there's no escape for the Grey Torcs, once they're collared?
They may escape, certainly. But should a wearer of either the Grey or Silver Torc come within the sphere of influence of a coercive Tanu, the human will be compelled to serve the exotic, even to giving up his life. This is why there can be no Torc wearers among us.
Except yourself, said Felice softly.
But those who wear gold are free, aren't they?
Claude was whittling a new rosary for Amaury. His Vitrador knife gleaming like sapphire in the firelight, he asked, "Can't the Torcs be cut off?"
"Not while the person lives," Madame replied. "We have tried, of course. It is not that the metal is so durable, but rather that the Torc somehow becomes bonded to the life force of the wearer. This bonding is accomplished after the Torc has been worn for an hour or so. Once a person has adapted to unfasten or sunder the device, brings death in convulsions. The mortal agony is similar to that inflicted by certain perverted redactors among the Tanu."
Felice leaned closer to the fire. She had finally taken off her armor after the 36-hour forced march to the tree, and the wet cloth of her green dress clung to her slight body. Her legs and upper arms, where they had not been protected by gauntlets and greaves, were a mass of scratches and deep bruises. News that the Tanu hunt had invaded the Vosges sent Madame and her scouting party, together with the remnant of Group Green, fleeing toward the tree refuge, where they had been met by other human renegades. Felice tried hard to be casual.
"So there is no way that you can remove your own Torc, Madame?"
The old woman gazed at the girl athlete for a long moment. At last, she said,
"You must not allow yourself to fall into temptation, my child. This golden Torc remains a part of me until my death."
Felice gave a light laugh.
"There's no need for you to be afraid of me. Just look into my mind and see." "I cannot read your mind, Felice, you know that. I am no redactor, and your strong latencies shield you. But many years at the Auberge gave me an insight into the personalities of others, such as yourself. And limited though my own metafunctions may be, I am in the confidence of the Fearvalog. And they read you like a child's primer."
"So that's it," Felice remarked obscurely. "I felt something."
"The Fearvalog have watched you almost from the beginning," the old woman said. "They always follow the caravans, the little people, hoping for some contretemps that will put the travelers into their power. So they behold you on the shore of the Lac de Bresse in your bid for freedom. They even aided you. Did you realize that? By adding images of confusion to the minds of the Chalicos and the soldiers, so that you and your friends were able to triumph."
"Ah, the Fearvalog were impressed by you, Felice. They saw your potential, but they also feared you, and quite rightly."
And so Fithorn, wisest among those who were following, caused a vivid illusion to seize the mind of one of your confrères.
"Tuchel!"
Felice cried, springing to her feet.
"C'est ça."
Richard gave an ironic cackle.
"Crafty spooks! I bet they could get that golden torque back out of the lake if they wanted to."
A chaotic mix of emotions played over the girl's face. She began to speak, but Madame held up her hand.
"The Fearvalog bestow their gifts only as they choose, not as we demand. You will have to be patient."
Claude said,
"So the Fearvalog followed us all the way. Don't tell me that they clouded the minds of our pursuers as well."
"Certainly," Madame Gudrion replied.
"Would not the boatful of Grey Torc marines have seen some trace of your own wake? Would not the tracking soldiers have found you in the forest in spite of your pathetic attempts to throw them off the scent?"
"But of course the Fivalog helped, and Fithorn also notified us of your presence in our Vosges forest, and so we came for you. His people also warned us of the hunt,
which does not usually penetrate deeply into the mountains. Richard tasted the stew again and grimaced. Now that we're here in a safe place, what happens? I'll be damned if I'm going to spend the rest of my life hiding out.
We do not enjoy it either. You have caused us a good deal of trouble by escaping into the Vosges. Ordinarily, the Tanu are inclined to let us be, and our free people reside in small homesteads or in secret villages. I myself live in Hidden Springs, which is near the future site of Plombières-les-Bains. But now, Lord Veltin of Fenaya is wild over the killing of Ipon. You must understand that no Tano has ever before been killed by a mere bare-neck human. Veltaine's flying hunt will now search out even the most remote of our settlements, hoping to find Felice. There will be Grey Hawk patrols everywhere, at least until the Tano become distracted by the preparations for the grand combat. As to what shall be done with you, we will discuss that when Pio and his warriors return. I have already perceived their approach.
Claude rolled one of the large rosary beads toward the little cat. The animal patted it toward Amarie, then arched its back in appreciation of its own cleverness. The nun picked up the cat and stroked it as it tried to nestle into her sling.
Do you have any news of the other escapees? The people in the boats? Our friend Yosh, the gypsies? Two of the gypsies survived their encounter at the ravine bridge. They will be guided here. There has been no word at all about the Japanese. The Fivalog in the northern regions are savage and not inclined to respect the alliance that their High King has formed with us. Your friend's chance of survival is not good. As to those in the boats, most were recaptured by Grey Hawk Marines from the lake forts. They are now imprisoned in Fenaya. Six escapees who reached the Jura shore are presently in the care of friendly Fivalog and will be taken to a free human refuge in the high mountains. Seven more?
Madame shook her head.
Were taken by Le Criard, the malign Fivalog, known as Howlers. What will happen to them? Amarie asked.
Madame lifted her shoulders and the golden torque reflected the flames.
These exotics! Ah, Master, they are barbaric, even the best of them, and the worst. Who shall even speak of their enormities? Fivalog and the Tanu are members of the same species. En vérité, they actually constitute a dimorphic race with a most peculiar genetic pattern. On their home planet, this led to an ancient antagonism between the two forms, the one tall and metaphysically latent, the other mostly short in stature and with limited operancy. You must understand that the exotics came to Earth in order to be free to pursue certain barbarous customs, holdovers from their archaic culture, that were justly proscribed by the civilized ones of their galactic confederation. Some of their cruel games are physical. The hunt, the grand combat, of which you will learn more later. But others are jeux d'esprit. Games of the mind.
The Tanu, with their wide-ranging latent metafunctions, do not favor this subtle jousting so much. It is more commonly the province of the torqueless Fivalog.
The little people possess some far-sensing power, plus one highly developed operant metafunction, that of creativity. They are masters of illusion. But what illusions they make! They are capable of driving humans, even the weaker among the Tanu, insane, with terror or anguish. Sensitive persons may even be killed outright from psychic shock. Fivalog can take the shape of monsters, devils, whirlwinds, conflagrations. They insinuate their delusions into more helpless minds and trigger suicide or self-mutilation. The latter is of great amusement to the worst of them, the so-called Howling Ones, since they are themselves deformed mutants. The weapons of the Fivalog are our own nightmares and fever dreams and fears and phantoms that assault one's imagination in dark places. They take a sadistic delight in destroying.
But they haven't destroyed you, Felice said. They gave you a golden torque. Why?
Because they hope to use me, of course.
I am to be a tool, a weapon, set adir, against their most deadly foe, the Tanu, their brothers.
Amarie said, and now you hope to use us.
Madame's thin lips lifted in a small smile.
It is obvious, is it not, Monsieur? You do not know how poor we are, what odds we have faced. The Tanu call us lowlives, and we have assumed the name proudly. Over many years our people have managed to escape from captivity, and were hardly thought to be worth pursuing. Most of us have no special talents that can be used against the exotics. But you, in your group, are different. The Tanu would take revenge upon you. But we lowlives see you as invaluable allies. You must join us. Felice, even without a torque, can control animals, even influence certain humans. She is physically strong and an experienced game-playing tactician. You, Amarie, are a doctor and a priest. My people have struggled for years without either. Richard is a navigator, a former commander of starships. For him there may be a key role in the liberation of humanity.
Now just a damn minute, bellowed the pirate, waving his soup ladle. Claude flipped bits of wood into the fire. Don't forget me. As an old fossil hunter, I can tell you exactly what Pliocene beast will be cracking your bones for the marrow after the Tanu and Firvalog get finished with you.
You are quick with a jest, Monsieur le Professeur, said Madame tartly. Perhaps the old fossil hunter will tell us his age?
133.
Then you are 2 years my senior, she retorted. And I will expect you to render good advice to our company as a result of your vast experience. As I lay before you my grand design, the plan for the liberation of humanity, give us your invaluable counsel. Correct any youthful impulsiveness that I may show.
Gotcha, Claude, Richard said, snickering. Say, if anybody cares, this vat of slumgullion is as ready as it will ever be.
Then we will eat, said Madame. And shortly Pio and the fighters will join us. She raised her voice. Mes enfants, you will all come to supper. Slowly, all of the people from the smaller fires approached, carrying bowls and drinking vessels. The total number of lowlives included perhaps 200, far more men than women, with a handful of children as quiet and alert as the adults. Most of the people were dressed in buckskin or homespun peasant garb. They did not seem to be outstanding physical specimens, nor were any of them decked out in the wildly eccentric fashion of certain timefarers in the Fenaya caravan. The lowlives did not look beaten or desperate or fanatical. In spite of the fact that they had just fled for their lives at Madame's mental alarm, they did not seem afraid. They saluted the old woman gravely or cheerfully, and many of them had a smile or even a joke for Richard and the other cooks dishing out the hastily prepared fare. If one word could be used to describe the guerrilla contingent, it might be ordinary. Amarie searched the faces of these free people, wondering what had inspired this relative handful to defy the exotics. Here were exiles whose dream had never come alive again. Was it possible that this small nucleus could grow, even prevail?
Good friends, Madame was saying. We have among us newcomers, whom all of you have seen, but few as yet have met. It is on their account that we have had to gather here. But we may hope, with their help, to reach our precious goal that much sooner.
She paused and looked about the company. There was no sound except the snap and sizzle of the fire logs.
As we eat, I will ask these new arrivals to tell us how they came from the prison of Castle Gateway to this free place.
Turning to the remnant of Group Green, she asked,
Who will be your speaker?
Who else? Richard said, pointing the ladle at Claude.
The old man rose to his feet. He spoke for nearly a quarter of an hour without interruption, until his narrative reached the point where Felice was about to initiate the attack upon Ipone. Then there was a loud hiss. Amory's little cat sprang from her arms and struck a stiff pose, facing the door of the tree like a miniature puma at bay.
"It is Pio," said Madame.
10 people, all heavily armed with bows and blades, came stamping and dripping into the shelter. They were led by a gigantic middle-aged man, nearly as massive as Stein, who wore the shell ornaments and fringed deerskin clothing of a Native American. Claude held off continuing his tale until these people were served with food and given a place close to the big fire. Then the paleontologist resumed and told the story to the end. He sat down, and Madame handed him a cup of hot wine. Nobody spoke until the gray-haired Native American said,
"And it was iron, iron, that killed the Lady Ipon."
"Nothing but," Richard declared. "She was chewed to pieces, and I let her have a couple of good ones with the bronze sword, but she still just about nailed me. Then something made me try Felice's little dagger."
The red man turned to the girl and demanded,
"Give it to me."
"And who the hell do you think you are?" she said coolly.
He roared with laughter, and the sound of it boomed in the hollow trunk of the tree as in an empty cathedral.
"I'm Pio Pio Mox Mox Burke, last chief of the Walla Walla tribe, and former justice of the Washington State Supreme Court. I'm also the one-time leader of this gang of Paskudniaks and its present sergeant-at-arms and warlord-in-chief. Now may I please examine your dagger?"
He smiled at Felice and held out a great hand. She smacked the golden scabbard into it smartly. Burke drew out the leaf-shaped little blade and held it up in the firelight.
"Stainless steel alloy, with an ever-sharp edge," the girl said. "A common toy on Akadi. Useful for picking teeth, cutting sandwiches, pricking out transponders from rustled cattle, and putting out the lights of casual assaulters."
"It seems quite ordinary, except for the gold of the hilt," Burke said.
"Amory has a theory about it," Claude said. "Tell him, child."
Burke listened thoughtfully as the nun set forth her hypothesis on the possible deadly effect of iron on torque-bearing exotics, then murmured,
"It could be. The iron disrupting the life force almost like a neural poison.